Today, the seventh of 10 commandments for Christians, really more maxims.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
If you've been keeping up, you are not surprised by our topic for today, the seventh out of these Ten Commandments for Christians, based on the real Ten Commandments. Of course, these are not they. It's not the same thing, nor do they carry the same weight. But in my best understanding, these are essentials to following Christ. They're essentials to a Christian perspective on seeing and living in the world. And today's particularly about living in the world and how we make choices about what we are going to do. The seventh of those Ten Commandments for us, and again, like I said, maxims, sort of guides for us to live by. The seventh of those for us is to pursue what is right before what works. This, if it comes from a single one of the Ten Commandments, would be, in my view, from number eight of the Big Ten, you know, the real Ten from Mount Sinai, which is, thou shalt not steal. Don't be a thief. Don't steal. Because we steal. We know stealing is wrong. Everybody knows stealing is wrong. We know it because we don't want people to take our stuff. So it doesn't even matter if you put a moral category on it. The fact that you would steal something has built into it the idea that you want it instead of someone else having it, which means you value personal possession. Otherwise, you wouldn't steal it, right? So we know stealing is wrong. We do it when the benefit outweighs the cost. The cost is just moral. I'm doing something I'm not supposed to do, but the benefit is the thing. I need this thing. I need to get it. And so we choose to do what works for us in the moment. And therefore, you know, as a basis for this commandment, I'm saying the idea that you would pursue what is right before what works is sort of an extension, an extrapolation of the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, into the general principle of how we live on making choices that are moral before we make choices that are purely functional or utilitarian. Now, obviously, this could just be an extension of all of the discussions I've had in the past about ethics and the way we should evaluate the difference between right and wrong in our lives and our behavior, socially and personally. Obviously, it involves both of those every time. But if I give a foundation to it, not just purely in ethics, but in a sense of how the Bible constantly presents choices that people make and how those choices are evaluated and whether they brought about good or bad, because that's the end, that's the what works part of what we're talking about, and whether they were the right choice or the wrong choice, that's the right of what we're talking about today. There is, I think, a stronger basis for making this statement, or at least a more universally present, more pervasive idea in Scripture underlying this concept, which, could be summed up in the two Proverbs that say basically the same thing, Proverbs 14:12 or 16:25. They say pretty much exactly the same thing. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death. Ironically, the discussion in that language in Proverbs 14, and we'll get to why this is later on, some of the confusion that goes on about right and good and how they compare with each other. Ironically, that statement in the Proverbs, there is a way that seems right to a man, but the end is the way to death. Its end is the way to death. It is ironically opposite of what I'm actually saying here. It seems like it is opposite of what I'm saying here. It actually is saying exactly the same thing. Because what it's saying is, oh, this person chose to do what was right. There's a way that seems right to a man. But it brought about a terrible result. And so it didn't work. Ooh, that was a dumb idea. But it's ironically the opposite of that that's going on. Because it's not right, it just seems right. And the idea that it seems right is based on the fact that he thought it was going to bring about life, meaning he thought this was going to work, and therefore it seemed like the right thing to do. But the nature of the proverb is to say, but the guy not only didn't do the right thing, which hopefully would have resulted in life, maybe, maybe not, but in choosing to do the thing he did that seemed right to him, the fact that it seemed right to him because it was going to work turned out to be the reason the stone rolled back on him to begin with. Well, you get the idea. If you know the other Proverbs, you get the idea of what I'm talking about there. So if I were to find a passage that actually explicitly makes this kind of claim, I would pull it from 2 Timothy 2. And this has a lot of the underlying ideas in it as well. So this is where Paul, obviously teaching Timothy how to be a more mature leader in his congregation in Ephesus and that so on. He says, "You then, my child, be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and what you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." So I'm handing something down to you that's valuable and should be an underpinning to everything you're going to do, and that you hand down to those who are coming after you. We'll talk more about that later as well. Share in suffering. And this is why this one makes the list of 10. For me. And again, my list didn't have to be 10. Could have been 20, could have been 40, could have been 8. I made it 10 because 10 is a nice round number. It's the number of commandments in the Old Testament, and it's the number of fingers we have on our hands. Those may be related issues. I don't know. God is over everything, so maybe that's what's going on. The point is, I chose 10, and if there are only 10, this was definitely going to be one of them. And part of that is the nature of the people of God always facing suffering. And suffering comes at those moments when you have to decide whether you're going to stay. Suffering brings these moments, and it also comes from these moments. It can be either one. And it's not always both, but it can be either one. Those moments when you have to decide whether you're going to stay planted in the good, when all the pressure is to give up the right thing, to give up whatever that right is, and choose I don't mean it in the simplistic way, but choose the easier path. If I can just do this, then my suffering will end. And that's why I put it with the stealing. If I could just steal that money, then I wouldn't have to pay this bill next month because I would already have paid it, and everything would finally be all right. If I could just cheat in this way, then I could get out of this class and everything would be done and I could just move on with my life and everything would be fine. And the nature of Old Testament and New Testament scripture, of Judaism and Christianity, is that being in the position of suffering and enduring it with integrity, the integrity that says I'm still going to do the right thing. That's so fundamental to everything in Scripture. It's so basic to what everything about Judaism and Christianity teaches that you just can't avoid it. And so it's here in this third verse of 2 Timothy 2. This is not the main point it's overt in just a moment. This commandment, this maxim is overt in just a moment. But in verse 3, the foundation for it is being laid in this statement: share in suffering as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. No soldier, in this metaphor that he gives, no soldier gets entangled in civilian pursuits, since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him. We're going to come back to the soldiering idea in just a moment, but there's a really important concept underneath this. that the whole concept of soldiers or police in the ancient world, and it's soldiers who were the enforcement arm, you know, of government or of social order. The whole question there was, when you give somebody a weapon and the authority to use that weapon, the abuse is sort of built in. I can get what I want from whoever I want because I'm authorized to kill people. I'm authorized to punish people. I've got a threatening tool with me that society won't punish me for using, and I can get something from it. And the point here is to say, if you're a follower of Christ, you have to decide that you're going to share in suffering and not pursue things of your own interest. Instead, that would be the civilian pursuits in the idea of soldiering. Instead, you are satisfied with what you have. We'll come back to the lines about John the Baptist answering the soldier later. You are satisfied with what you have. You're not pursuing any of that. And so even in suffering, you're content with the fact that you have Christ. And so in the analogy, he says, no soldier gets entangled in civilian pursuits. This is back to 2 Timothy 2. Since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him. An athlete, he's not out to please himself. He's out to please whoever enlisted him as a soldier. You're not out there fighting your own battle. You're not picking on your own enemies. You're not using your weapons for your own purposes. You're given this because you're serving someone else. So an athlete, in the same way, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. Now, the rules aren't, this is not a list of arbitrary rules that we're talking about. This is a metaphor. In athletics, you have a list of arbitrary rules. Well, it's going to be 100 yards long, and we're going to do the race in this way, and you can't go until the gun fires, and blah, blah, blah. The nature of following those rules is the metaphor for the things that are right, that we know are right for us to do. And so he says, it is the hardworking, in another analogy, farmer who ought to have the first share of the crops. Hardworking means he was out there in the field doing things when there was no reward. But it was the right thing to do in the moment, metaphorically. It was the right thing for him to do in the moment. And so the reward comes later. So think over, he says, what I say, because the Lord will give you an understanding in everything. In 2 Timothy 2, he says, you don't get to participate in the fruits of all of this unless you've chosen to do what is right. First, choose to do what is right, and then pursue what works. It makes sense to be concerned about whether something's going to bring a good result or not. That's natural to us. But we can't do that first. And so the maxim is pursue what is right before what works, meaning pursue what is right before you pursue what's going to work, what's going to make things happen. And again, we're in a pragmatist society. So just saying this is sort of challenging for most of us because our nature is only to care about things that are going to work. But we can't claim that we're being faithful to the Christian tradition or to the lessons that Christ taught us in his own life if we're asking questions about what's going to work or be effective before we're even asking whether it would be right or wrong. We don't get that prerogative once we choose to put our faith in Christ. In Matthew 16, it comes up this way. This is in the, you know, the exchange between Jesus and Peter where he renames Peter. It's the Caesarea Philippi confession. He said that, so Jesus turns around to his disciples. This is after Peter, hey, who am I? You're the rock. And then, oh yeah, well, I'm also going to go to the cross. No, you can't do that. Well, then you're not a rock, you're Satan. You know, after all that exchange, Jesus turns to the disciples and says, if anyone would come after me, this is the core of what it means to be following Christ. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. Ourselves in this thing, this is a metonym. It's a way of replacing one idea with another. The idea is the stuff we want, that's us. That's what we want. That's what we're pursuing naturally when we're affirming ourselves. We're just taking the things we want. Denying yourself means turning away from the things you want. That means the stuff that works, the stuff that gets what you desire. So if he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. First, you have to say no to the stuff that works for you, to the stuff that would make your life the way you want it to be. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and instead take up his cross and follow me. Whoever would save his life, that is, you're pursuing the stuff that works for you. You're doing the stuff that gives you what you need, what you want, whatever it is. That's the person who's going to lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake is willing to put that stuff off. But for my sake, to do what is right, to follow me, That's the person who will find it. What does it profit a man anyway if he gains the whole world but forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? And in that moment, you realize that we're not created to feed ourselves. We're not created to provide for ourselves whatever we want, but for something that is simply right. Our soul has been given a purpose, and we either fulfill that or we pursue all the other stuff. We have to choose the right thing first. That's why the idea of trust and faith, you know, in the old hymn, trust and obey, those words, they get put together properly, because in discipleship and throughout all of Scripture, the relationship is inherently between having trust in God, meaning having faith in God. And I know those are not identical words, but they do convey the same concept here. Having trust in God, meaning actually having faith in God, does mean obeying God, which means God tells us to do things we would not have wanted to do otherwise, but because we trust him, we do what is right, and then we worry about the results, the consequences, because we believe he can manage those consequences better than we can anyway. That's part of the reason we do it. Now, here's the thing. That's just the foundation for why we want to have this discussion. Here's the thing. It gets very confusing how to talk about this, because what works means it brings about stuff that we want. That's what the works part of this is. So saying pursue what is right before what works means making moral choices before we make utilitarian choices, making choices about what's right and wrong before we make choices about what's going to bring a good result to us. That can be particularly challenging for us, but it ultimately comes down to the difference between two words that I've talked about before, but I need to clarify for us here as well, and it's the difference between the words good and right. The distinction is important. Good is, it's psychological. Ultimately, it's about stuff we want. Do you desire it or don't you desire it? If you desire it, it's good. If you don't desire it, it's bad. It's a word about ends. It's not a word about the inherent nature of a thing. It's a word about beauty, for instance. So aesthetics fits into the category of axiology, the things that we value or don't value, so the things that we consider good or bad, better or worse, in the same way that morality fits into that category. And this is where it becomes so tricky, because good is a psychological question. Right is a moral question. Is this thing right or wrong? The confusion happens. Just, you understand the difference between those two. So just to clarify, corn is a good. I want corn on the cob. It is therefore a good. It's a thing that is good and I want it. A beautiful painting is a good. It's a thing that I desire to be in the presence of, and because of that, it is a good. Saying something is right, telling the truth is right, may not be something I want at all. I may not desire it at all. But it is morally better, and this is the trick, because I just used the word better, which just means more good, right? So it's better. So right is moral, not psychological. It is in the act itself. It is in the object itself, not just in my psychological opinion of it. So even when I feel like it is better to tell this lie, lying is still wrong in one way or another. Lying is still going to be wrong. You go back and listen to shows we've had about ethics and moral dilemmas and all that kind of stuff, and you can go through the haggling, the details of all that kind of stuff. That's not the point for today. The point is that good is a term we use about psychological condition of desiring something. Right is a term we should use about a moral condition for something, like an action of ours. It's either right or wrong. So good and bad are contrasts. Right and wrong are contrasts. They don't mean the same thing. Here's the confusion. Rights are also good. Things that are right are also things that we at least ought to desire. We at least ought to desire what is right. That is, we ought to think of right as something that's good. The problem is sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. And it doesn't change whether it's right or wrong, whether we desire it or not. That is, the fact that we think it's good or not good doesn't make it right or wrong. Our psychological condition doesn't change the moral value of it. Now, I say that like it's a super simple question. But it's not super simple. It is quite confusing for a number of reasons, because, and it's why sometimes we do regard a right as something we desire, a good, and sometimes we don't. Part of moral maturity, which we sometimes will think of as socialization or enculturation or self-discipline. And it's all those different things as well as something beyond it. I get it. I'm not purely cultural in my understanding of ethics, nor would I be. But part of moral maturity or socialization or whatever is training ourselves to desire the things that are right, to desire the right things, right? And to retreat, to learn to retreat from the things that are actually wrong. So we learn not to lie and to tell the truth. We learn not to steal just because we want something, but instead to respect personal property and so on. That's part of moral maturity. That's great. And here's something. So we say, here's something, right? We don't like it. Like, oh, I have to keep this promise even though it's going to cost me a mint. So, you know, keeping a promise to our own disadvantage is one of those signs of moral maturity. So here's something, right? We don't like it, but we do it. And then over time, our conscience or social sanction kicks in. And social sanction, you know, I mean, like a rap across the knuckles it used to be. Or maybe it's just a frowning look from your teacher now. Whatever it is, it's a social sanction of some kind. So we do this thing that's right that we didn't really want to do. But then our conscience and social sanction helps with this, kicks in, and then we learn to like it. A right becomes a good. That's a normal human psychological development, and that's what every two-year-old has to learn. Two-year-olds, inherently demon-possessed, and then over time, we kick the demons out of them with frowns, not with corporal punishment anymore, but whatever, however you think about that, and the demons flee and they become responsible citizens. And in the process, they develop an understanding that some things that are right are actually desirable. So they become good. That's fine. Or on the opposite side of that, here's something that's wrong and, oh, we like it. That's a problem. You know, I like to eavesdrop, or I like to tell lies, or, you know, I like to get away with stealing something every once in a while or something like that. So we do it, but then conscience, or that social sanction we were talking about, kicks in, and historically, somewhat literally kicks in, you know, kicks us. And then we learn not to like it. And so over time, what we always hope is, and what Freud refers to as a superego develops, what we always hope is that our moral sense and our aesthetic sense, our taste for things, can coincide. They can converge into the same interests. But sometimes that, and this is going to be a discussion after the Ten Commandments episodes are done. We will come back to this at some great length. But sometimes even that leads to even more confusion when we think that because, oh, we've learned to desire something that we used to hate, it must be one of those moral accomplishments in the development of my virtue. Sometimes what we have learned to like because of our social approbations and sanctions are actually things that are not right. But they feel right, and we feel like we had to learn the discipline of embracing those things ourselves. We train ourselves to get used to something, even to desire it, which was originally loathsome to us, and we consider ourselves more virtuous because we now enjoy doing what normal people, we would say to ourselves, I'm putting air quotes up, normal people can't stand the thought of. So, you know, you can think of if you think back to the discussion we had with our surgeon friend, Alan Peets, you can realize how confusing this issue could be. Oh, I'm okay with cutting people open and doing things to their bodies that they would never want someone to do to them if they were conscious, but that you need someone to do to you when you're sick. So again, go back and listen to that conversation with him to get an idea of how confusing, how difficult or challenging this can become, but also how important it is for us to step up and to learn some moral things like that. But you can imagine if the pressures to do those things are coming from the wrong side in society or coming from a society that itself is somehow wrong, it can be a real problem. This is one of the weaknesses that seems to me to be built into virtue ethics. I'm a Kantian ethicist, in case you're an ethicist and care about the labels here, and I'm not attacking all of virtue ethics. Every ethical system has its challenges. But one of the challenges in virtue ethics is precisely this. Virtue is taken as, you know, I mean, it's the old word for manliness. You know, it's full maturity of manhood. You've arrived at the telos of what a full adult male ought to be. And so you can understand how an example of the confusion that I'm talking about here could come when men have grown up to develop a tolerance for those ultra-masculine features. So the idea of toxic masculinity is not all misguided. The celebration of those things that really we probably ought to withdraw from can be evidence that we've been properly socialized to actually embrace wrong things as right. So you can get a lot of confusion can happen about what's right and what's good, and then whether the rights become goods or not, and so on. So what I want us to do is just back up a little. I'm not going to try to extract all of those nuances out today. That's not the goal for today. The goal for today is to recognize, I know how confusing and how difficult this can be to handle in its finer nuances. I get that. But what we have to do is decide that right is more important than utilitarian or functional or what works, and choose to do this first. It's not like what works isn't important. It's incredibly important. But what's right has to come first if we're going to claim that we're taking a Christian approach to the things that we face. This problem, the whole confusion between good and right that we've been talking about, can make morality, really the right and wrong part, really difficult to grasp. You know, so on the one hand, we're trained to embrace as right the things that socialize us, make us responsible parts of society. This is what I'm saying here. This is that confusion part that I'm talking about. So on the one hand, we're trained to embrace as right the things that make us responsible parts of society, the things that socialize us. On the other hand, we often find ourselves running in social circles that compel us toward behaviors which make our own conscience, the part inside of us that's supposed to be saying, you know, that's good, I commend you for that, or that's wrong, I condemn you for that. It can make our own conscience really uncomfortable when we're running with some of those parts of society. And so, you know, I would say these two things to get out of this little part of the conversation we're having right now. This is for those of us that are inclined to cooperation. And I think some are inclined toward cooperation, some are inclined toward resistance. You know, no matter what people are doing, they're going to say no. And in other cases, no matter what people are doing, they're going to kind of join in the crowd. We all have an inclination one direction or the other. So for those of us who are inclined to cooperation, I'd say it's important to find the difference between respect for social order and complicity in social evil. We have to find that line. And for those of us who are inclined toward individual or personal conviction, it's important to find the difference between a psychopath and a prophet. It's not always, and that's not always an easy line. And I don't mean that technically, like, you know, I have some idea of what some diagnosis of psychopathy is. But I do mean this. You think of the shift in moral sentiments about marijuana over the last couple of decades. You know, how are we supposed to regard Woody Harrelson back in that day? Was he just antisocial, slightly psychopathic, or was he a messenger of a better future, slightly prophetic? I'm no fan of legalized marijuana, nor am I a fan of all the drug laws. So I don't have a dog in this hunt. I'm not trying to make a point about marijuana or whatever, you know, you're taking for gummies to help you sleep at night. I don't care about it. I mean, I care, but that's not the point for today. But my question stands, you know, when a person takes their stand against society and says, you're not going to compel me to do it, are they just ignorant of the social pressures that ought to help them be more moral? Or are they courageous enough to stand against the currents of society and offer a prophetic voice to it? Obviously, we need prophets, but obviously we also need social cohesion. So again, I'm not pretending that we can resolve all of that or that the dilemmas aren't present or make this discussion challenging. It does, but it doesn't change the fact that our first question always has to be, what is right? What is the right thing for us to do? Then we can consider what works. So I'll give you a few examples of applications where we're tempted to think wrongly about this, or where the fact that we see the world pragmatically is pretty evident. By pragmatically, I mean we pursue what works, not what is right. We're just doing what works and then saying, well, it must have been right. I mean, I got the right results. That's what I'm saying we have to dismiss as language. We can't say that. We cannot simply say, well, it worked. You know, it got the right results. I mean, that's all that matters. That's never all that matters. Not if you want to look at the world from a Christian perspective. It just doesn't work that way. The scriptures just don't give us that kind of latitude. It erases the concept of faith in God or obedience to him or trust in him, even in times of our suffering. So examples, beginning any discussion about public policy with whether it will bring the best result is evidence that we think incorrectly about this. And right now, that's all we do. Elections are almost always decided on economic terms. They're not decided philosophically. It's just whoever's going to offer a chicken in the pot, who's going to help us be wealthier. That is not thinking about right before thinking about what works. I understand why. I understand why, because we're thinking socially and we're thinking politically and we're thinking personally and about our own profit in the process. But that's the problem. And I will put some other examples on that in public policy in just a minute. They'll come up on their own. But let me give you another way of thinking about this. So what we have to do to think about this, and to get to the examples that I want to give you, is we have to think about it in terms of two questions. You know, and so what it should be is this. The first question should always be, what's the right thing to do? And then after we've asked the question, what's the right thing to do? Is this thing right or wrong? Then we get to ask the second question. How much is that going to cost? And how do we balance the good stewardship of our resources against the moral obligation we have in this situation? In other words, what's the most effective way to do this thing that we think is right? So the first decision is about what's right. The second decision is about how or to what extent to do that thing that's right. That is just built into decision making. You have to do both. If you're going to be moral at all, you have to do both. What we often fall into is only doing the second question. Now, we pretend that we're asking the second question, what's going to work? How are we going to solve this problem? And then we ask the first question, is this moral or not? The problem with doing it in reverse is that we can always find a way to rationalize what we're going to do that works. Always. It's the moral triviality that Paul Ramsey describes in a lot of circumstances, where we can always find some ethicist who will get out in front of us and say, oh, I can make a way to explain why you should do that because it brings about a better benefit for more of society or whatever it is. That's never going to work from a Christian perspective. So if we're doing that, if we're asking the questions in the right case, then we look at moral dilemmas and we think about them differently. It does make sense to say, we have to ask a question. Do we adopt this policy, you know, whatever the policy is, some legislative question or just some personal decision about how we're going to vote? Do we adopt this policy and save 10,000 lives or that contradictory policy over there and save 100,000 lives? We have to answer questions like that sometimes. We have choices like that sometimes. But on this model, the first question has to be, is it right to have such a policy, either one, at all? Would it be right to have this policy regardless of the consequences at all? Then the second question can be, well, which policy is going to make more sense? Which policy is going to bring more practical benefit? Which policy is going to work better? But only after you've decided that one or the other or both is actually right in its own standing. So as an example, indiscriminate bombing, and I mean carpet bombing in Dresden or using nuclear weapons on entire cities or whatever you want to talk about. So in Dresden, there were probably 25,000 people killed. Now, I'm not talking soldiers. We're talking carpet bombing over the whole city. If, and you can go back and read about, you know, the Dresden bombings before. This was before the atomic bombs were dropped. Or the fire bombings in Tokyo, same kind of idea, and all over Japan that were going on towards the end of World War II. If we ask the second question first, If we ask the functional question first, then yeah, it makes sense to save lives in future battles by intimidating and decimating an enemy into submission. You just destroy their families, destroy their children, kill their wives, and all of a sudden they're going to submit to what we're trying to do. And then we don't have to fight all those battles that were going to come, and who knows how many men's lives can be saved from those battles. Fine, you ask that. When I say fine, I mean, yeah, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. If you ask the question about what works first. But if you ask the question about what is right first, if you ask the first question first, then it's just not right to use indiscriminate violence even in war, even just war theory. It includes the principle of discrimination. There is a difference between firing on someone who is firing on you and firing on people who are trying to take their children to the hospital, to use current examples. In the same way, if we were to talk about medical dilemmas instead of war and bombings, you know, the doctrine of the double effect deals exactly with this. You don't have to know the name of it, but in a lot of biomedical ethics questions, this comes up, that you'll have a medical procedure that has both a positive and a negative consequence built into it. And what the doctrine of the double effect does, and it's just a way people think about this question historically, especially from a Catholic influence, by the way, which has been helpful in terms of biomedical ethical questions. This essentially ensures that we end up asking the first question first and then asking the second question. That is, that we ask first the question, is it right? And then we ask, well, is it going to work or not? And the doctrine of the double effect literally has three questions for this. This is when a single act is going to have both positive and negative consequences. So, for instance, a person is coming to the end of their life. This is the classic example. Person's coming to the end of their life, and they're in extreme suffering, and the only way to relieve the suffering is to give them something like morphine. But you give them morphine, you relieve the suffering, you also reduce their rate of respiration, their ability to clear fluid from their lungs, and you, in effect, hasten their death. You bring about an earlier death. And so how do we relieve their suffering and hasten their death? But we're not supposed to hasten their death. So what are we supposed to do? There's a double effect to this single act. What are we supposed to do with that? And so what you do is you ask three questions. If you approach this from the perspective that says, first ask what's right, and then figure out what's going to work. And the three questions go like this in the doctrine of the double effect. Number one, is the act itself morally wrong? Is it wrong for us to inject someone with something that's going to relieve their suffering? And the answer is no to that. So yeah, this can be a right thing to do. The second question is the one that's particular to the doctrine of the double effect. Does the benefit derive only from the negative effect, or does it come directly from the action? Are we relieving their suffering because they're dying, or are we relieving their suffering because we're giving them a medication that will help alleviate the pain itself? However morphine works. I don't know how it works. But, you know, the consequence of just relieving their suffering. And the answer on this one is no. It's a direct effect of the morphine to relieve their suffering. Then you ask the functional question, the works question at the end. Is the benefit of the positive effect worth the harm of the negative effect? And that's a balancing act. There's not a definite answer to it. It's not an easy question to answer. If someone is within a day or two of dying and you can relieve their suffering, but you may hasten their death by an hour or two, most people are going to say, yeah, definitely relieve their suffering. But you're not going to do it if you're talking about a 9-year-old kid and you're going to hasten their death by 70 years if you give them an injection right now. Obviously, there's a lot of area in between there where there are a lot of debates to be had, but this is the debate that should not be had. That is, if it is had, it should be resolved the same way every time if we're going to claim that we're bringing to this some kind of Christian worldview. It should have built into it that the first question we ask is whether it's right or not. And then the questions that follow are about what makes it work best. Always the first question is it right or not? If I put it in the context of a different application, policing or soldiering, like we were talking about at the beginning when I gave you the example, when we were talking about at the very top, the example of Paul teaching Timothy how to apply this idea. You have to follow the rules, Timothy. You have to understand what's right or wrong, and you have to commit yourself to following Christ before you decide you're going to do the things that are practical in your own life, whatever. in that policing or soldiering example, that literally is a question that comes up with John the Baptist, not as a metaphor, but literally with people who are working for the government. In this case, a bureaucrat, a tax collector, meaning to the Jews, a turncoat, you know, a person who's serving the Roman Empire instead of the interest of the Jewish people. In their view, a tax collector comes to John the Baptist, and then soldiers, who are even worse. I mean, these are the people who are actually taking up arms against their own people on behalf of the Roman government. So tax collectors come to John the Baptist to be baptized by him, and they say to him, "How do we repent? What do we do?" And he said to them, "Don't collect more than you're authorized to do." And then you think later in the story, obviously, to Zacchaeus and him being able to follow that example when he's confronted by Christ. Anyway, don't collect more than you're authorized to do. And then the soldiers come to John the Baptist. It's the same question, essentially. It's just their tools are different. Soldiers ask him, "What about us? What are we supposed to do?" And he said to them, "Don't extort money from anyone by threats or false accusations, and be content with your wages." So if you put that in terms of the questions we're talking about, the first question, is this right or not, is simply, am I allowed to use my public servant role for my private benefit? No. The answer is no. It's not right for you to use a public servant role for your own personal benefit. If I were to ask the question a different way, it would be to say this to get a positive answer. Am I allowed to be a public servant? Yes. Yes, you're allowed to be a public servant. John doesn't say, you can't be a tax collector, you can't serve the Roman Empire and also be a Christian. He doesn't say that to them. He says, just don't extort money from people. Don't collect more than you're authorized to do. Am I allowed to be a public servant? Yeah, of course you are. There's not an exclusion from that in Christianity somewhere. But then the second question, well, what about what works for me? You know, what about the benefits that come to me? The second question would be, how can I be the best public servant and not be in it for my own benefit? Because that wouldn't be right. To use public service for private benefit, that's inherently wrong. It's in the name, public servant, right? So I can't do that. If I ask the two questions in order, then I get a resolution to all kinds of problems that lead to immoral behaviors and behaviors that are self-destructive, not necessarily in terms of my profit or my success in this life, but in terms of my soul. If a man gains the whole world and loses his own soul, what's the point, right? As Jesus says it. So here's a caution, just to be clear at the end of what I'm talking about. We should be willing to obey God, do what's right, regardless of the consequences to us. Now, it's important to, I'm going to nudge this one direction and then the opposite and then back. Love and empathy and compassion and kindness, those are absolutely intertwined and they're fundamental to what is right. On the other hand, moral dilemmas do force us to do hard things in contrast with what our compassion might wish for us to do at times. Again, that conversation with Alan Peetz is a perfect example of that. But then you learn to have a bigger compassion, right? So there are times when we want, as a professor, there are times I want to give a good grade to everyone. I love my students. They all ought to get A pluses. Everybody should get an A plus, even though we don't give A pluses. We only give A's. I don't know, for some confusing reason. Whatever. The point is, I want to give a good grade to everyone. But what does that mean? You know, so I'm going to be compassionate to the student who didn't do very much work, but I'm going to give them a good grade anyway. What does that do to the students who really have worked the hardest and earned the better grade? They don't get a better grade. They're getting the same thing everybody else got. How am I distributing compassion when I'm doing that? There are times when it's legitimate to ask if the good we're doing some is worth the harm we're doing to others. And again, I'm not trying to have the moral debate right now. I'm just trying to get morality first on our list right now. So, like on the immigration question, this is exactly what both sides are trying to claim as their moral high ground. The anti-immigration forces, that's what they are. You can call them whatever you want to call them. That's what they are. The anti-immigration forces, they say the compassion that we extend to immigrants is doing real harm to citizens for whom we also have obligations. And there are arguments to be made about that. On the other side, the pro-immigration forces say that the protection or empathy that we're extending to citizens is doing real harm to immigrants for whom we also ought to have compassion. That's what we're saying. First, let's figure out what's right, and then let's solve the problem. I don't think both sides are doing that equally. I do have strong opinions on it, but that's not the point for today. The point for today is to get that right, moral right question on the table first. So on the other side, I said we'd go one way and then go the opposite way. On the other side, you can't just become cold-hearted about all this. Well, I know that's going to hurt you, but it's better for you. It's going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. And then wham, you know. We cannot become inured to the needs of others. Our empathy is part of what God demands for us to have. Proverbs 21:13, to get it back to the book of Proverbs, whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. James's way of saying the same thing, but not about specific poverty, but just those who need some mercy, meaning they've made a mess, but they need somebody to have compassion on them. His statement is this: judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. I never use this claim. Well, I'm just doing what's right. I know it hurts everybody, but I've got to do what's right. And I can. If what you're doing is harming people, then it should bother you. It should bother us. Now, that does, again, there are times when we have to do things that are difficult, but it's important never to turn that sentiment off. In our evaluation of means and ends, in other words, of, you know, rights and goods, means and ends, we have to remember that God has defined other people as ends in themselves. It's always going to come down to loving other people. The entire Law and Prophets hangs on that. So if we're going to do things within the framework of the world Jesus describes with his life, then we will learn to pursue what is right before what works.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.